In the bestseller Jack Kennedy, elusive hero Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball, unearths key clues that help explain the greatness and the true enigma of JFK and presents a new look at an American hero who has fascinated Matthews his entire life. It's a great pleasure to welcome Chris Matthews back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure.
Thank
to have
you for having me, Joe. You've said it all the way I look at it. It's an enigmatic person who's become almost an iconic being rather than as a regular person. And we don't think of him as a regular person, you know, who shaves in the morning, goes to the bathroom, falls asleep at night, you know, lives a normal life. We think of him as almost beyond all that. And it's just interesting when that happens in history.
What is it about that enigma that you wanted to unveil, in a sense, of look at him as a whole?
Well, the fact that he lived a life that he never shared with everybody. I mean, he had a relationship with Jacqueline Kennedy, his wife, and his kids, but that was a portion of his life. He sort of lived his life like a great ocean liner, like the Titanic, all these separate compartments. And he would enter into each one of these compartments. One would be his old Irish mafia, the guys who work with him in politics. But none of them would ever go to dinner with him. He'd never have them around during social occasions. He'd have some old elite friends he went to prep school with, like Charlie Bartlett or Chuck Spalding. And they would never meet the other guys, the real ruthless Irish guys that he had working in politics. He would have intellectual friends like Schlesinger and Galbraith, but they would never hang with the other guys. He'd have his girlfriends, the ones he was serious about, the ones he wasn't serious about, all in separate compartments. He lived this life where he was the captain of his ship, but only he could enter all the compartments. And so everybody knew, even Ben Bradley, who was his buddy, only knew a part of him. He would have part of his life where he'd hang out with guys who had good marriages and were very faithful husbands, like Ben Bradley and people like Red Fay and Charlie Bartlett, and in a couple of cases, very Catholic guys. And then he would hang out with other guys like Spalding and Torby McDonald, who he'd out and chase girls with, almost like double dating with, and actually go out with bimbos, if you will. And so he would have this different, that's why it was very hard to get a handle on all of it. And so what I tried to do was interview as many people as I could who really were his pals. And when they were passed away, I would go get their oral histories and really dig into it. But I was fortunate because I knew guys like Red Fay, and I knew guys like I know Charlie Bartlett and Ben Bradley, and I did interview Chuck Spalding. I knew him, and I did know Billy Sutton, who was his first guy he hired, and I did know Dave Powers. So having worked in politics all my life, especially in that Kennedy world, I was able to get to guys who knew him, and I really wanted to tell that story.
You know, one of the things when you talk about those friendships and those relationships is here is a guy who didn't like to be alone. It was compartmentalized, but boy, he wanted folks around him.
That's so true. I think of other people that wanted to be alone. I mean, he would have nights when Jacqueline was away. She spent the summers at the Cape. He would have Dave Powers sit with all night and drink Heinekens with him, and he would want to have him with him, smoke cigars, be buddies. He needed a buddy around him. Even when he went swimming at lunchtime, he wanted to have a buddy with him. Even when he had girls around, to be blunt about it, he wanted to have a buddy with him. It was he just loved the camaraderie of other guys, and really I think the Navy experience when he had crewmen like that who really liked hanging out with him. He was a delight, of course, to hang out with. People said being with him was like being at a fair. It was always fun. He made everything fun, even when he was in tight spots with the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was always this sense of life is great with Jack Kennedy. I mean, he was absolutely winning as a person to be with. People, you just wanted to meet him because you never know how he would treat you because he was a bit of an elitist. But he was the kind of guy you want to be and you wanted to be around.
His wife, Jackie, described him, as you write in the book, a combination of bad and good. But in the book, you get a sense that she very much understood him. She knew him. She knew what she was dealing with.
The bad and good part's fascinating because Teddy White, who got the first interview with her the Friday after Jack was killed, she said all men are a mix of bad and good. And, of course, Teddy transposed it to good and bad for the Life magazine piece. But I got his original text where he said bad and good, his notes. And she knew his life. She knew that he'd been unfaithful. She knew all that about him. But she had this sense of him. It was almost soul-like. She said that he was not this good-looking guy with the great tan and the smile and the great hair and all, dashing figure, but he was still inside the sick young kid who was all alone growing up. He was always at boarding school or in a hospital, often in a hospital for his bad stomach, his bad back. He was always sick, and always alone reading books of Ivanhoe and the Knights of the Round Table, and then later Churchill. He read Churchill's account of World War I when he's only 14. His parents never visited him. He was very much alone, a loner kid, until he met a good friend of his, Lem Billings, who became his friend for life. He was always the loner. And she said he's still that young romantic kid dreaming of heroes. And that's, of course, who he became, a lover of heroes, a guy who became a hero himself. And that was the real Jack. So I think she held to not just the charisma, the handsomeness of the guy, whatever, but the real Jack, the spiritual Jack of youth. And she really had that romantic notion about him, which she talked about when she came out with the Camelot notion with that Teddy White interview, where she sort of cooked up the notion of Camelot after he'd been killed.
In talking about his health, as you just did, of always being in great physical pain and being that sick kid,
yeah.
One of the things you write about that I was blown away, I didn't realize this, one of the many things I learned in the book, he received the last rites three times.
Before the last time.
Yeah.
Yeah, before Dallas. He was in 47. He was over in England hanging out with Pamela Churchill at the time, Randolph's wife, who later was divorced, and hanging around with her and... He got his first real episode of Addison's disease. He turned blue. I mean, he would change colors. The guys who worked with him said he'd come to work as a young congressman, different colors every day. It's almost unimaginable how sick he was from Addison's disease. And he would cover it up with his tan and say it was malaria. It wasn't malaria. It was Addison's disease. And he had to have the last rites then. And then he was over in Okinawa with Bobby on a trip to the Far East, and he got another episode of it. And Bobby really made his name with Jack and became his protector when he got him to a military hospital in Okinawa. And saved his life. And then, of course, he had the bad back operation, which broke bad, which they all did. And he had the complications set in, I think it was early 54, he had the last rites again at the hospital. I mean, his life was, for a guy that looked like he had it made to all of us growing up, he really did look like he had it made. In fact, he would say things like, I mean, my life is, the quality of my life couldn't get any better, only the quantity of it, he said to one of his girlfriends. But he wasn't a complainer. He was like a World War II guy, which he was. He never complained about all his illnesses, except one time he said to Jackie, she said, what would you like that you don't have? And he said, more good days. Because so many of his days, and if you look at the old films, you see him sitting in the rocking chair. He covered it up so well. You can, if you make it a real effort, you can see that he was always wearing a corset under his shirt, a brace. You could see the pain he was in, the very careful way he walked. You know, he had one leg 3/4 of an inch shorter than the other. He had his bones were degenerating like osteoporosis early onset. You know, it's hard to believe how you put it together with the guy, the way he presented himself. It's even having written the book and studied all this stuff and the health reports and his medical history and how horrible it was. And part of it was he was taking amphetamines. He was taking steroids that gave him this great sense of well-being, especially the steroids. And amphetamines that kept them up a lot more than, you know, that's dangerous. I had a diet pill once, and once you've had one, they're quite enjoyable, but you can't get hooked on them. And he was pretty much on them, yeah. And I think that gave him his sense of vivacity that overcame the pain.
But as you say, with that as the baseline of his illness and how it permeated his life, you almost do a double take when you read the stories of his heroism during the war and his great courage as president.
Well, just think about this. It's the middle of the night, and your boat's just been cut in half by a Japanese destroyer that cuts within 11 feet of you, and you go through what feels like the experience of dying, as he put it. He felt like he was dying with a concussion when that ship hit him and cut right through at 40 knots. Didn't even stop. May not have even known it had done it, this big ship paralleling through him. He had to dive into the gasoline-burning water, the crackle of gasoline fire all around him, save the life of Pappy McMahon, haul him back to what was left of the ship in the bow, got them aboard the bow, and then the next day, because he knew the bow was sinking and it turned over like a turtle, he knew the ship was the boat, what was left of it was sinking. He got his guys to swim for 4 hours, and he had Pappy McMahon on his back the whole 4 hours, carrying him on his back, while his own back was in terrible shape because he had already gone in the Navy with a very fragile back that he should have been in the Navy with, because he snuck, basically got through the physical, through training and everything, got through the physical. And yet he was doing this with a bad back, all those 4 hours carrying McMahon on his back and organizing the rest of the swimmers and the non-swimmers. There were a lot of guys that couldn't swim back then, believe it or not. And he made sure they got on a plank that they found floating in the water, and he got half five men on one side of the plank who were not swimmers, and the swimmers joining them, and they got He had them stick together. He put his executive officer in charge of keeping those guys together. So he was a captain right through this, saving his crew when they finally got to the island. Then they had to swim to another island, and another island he went to, the third island. And all the time he's out there at night sneaking out in the water to try to flag down a PT boat so they wouldn't be captured by the Japanese. He was a very heroic figure through all the pain. You're right. It was. It's hard to put it together, except it's all true.
Chris Matthews is the author of the book Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. When it comes to our current day politics, how much of a shadow, how much of a does his legacy still burn bright in Washington, do you think?
Well, I think for people of my generation, I'm in my 60s, people who grew up, I think, in the late 50s and early 60s, if they're reading the paper, paying attention to all of what was going on, I don't think they can imagine the presidency without thinking of Jack. In the same way that the people who grew up in the 30s can't imagine the presidency without thinking of FDR. To us, I think he's the iconic president, the hero president. And I think that, I guess in the same way, Hemingway, whatever you think of his writing ability, and I think there's a lot below the surface with his writing ability, a lot more in the backstory than maybe is in print, in the way he suggested things brilliantly. I think people grew up wanting to be writers because of Hemingway, and they want to be politicians because of Kennedy. I think he was that kind of a leader. So it's hard for me to imagine a Bill Clinton without thinking that Jack Kennedy played an enormous role in leading him into public life. And the same with President Obama and a lot of other people in both parties. I think they were, for whatever reasons of superficial or deep reasons, Kennedy inspired them.
Do you think we could ever have we have it with FDR, we have it with JFK, we have it to Reagan to a certain extent, of this an understanding or at least an agreement or at least an understanding of the powerful nature of the men and their presidency? In this divided culture, do you think we can achieve that again?
Great. It's a great question. Can we live in the age of Roosevelt again? Can we live in the age of Kennedy, the Kennedy era, the new frontier? Can a president establish such an aura about his time that it becomes his time? That's a great question. I never thought of that. I think it is increasingly hard because John Boehner, right now as we talk, is challenging that to some extent, although I think he might agree to it at some point in terms of the numbers of this fiscal cliff thing. But I think that there is a sense. Yeah, it's very hard for a president to be like the universal leader of a country right now in the way that they were able to before, because when I worked for Tip O'Neill in those years, he accepted the fact that we lived in the age of Reagan. He was the opposition leader, but he accepted it was Reagan's era. I don't think Boehner accepts the fact in the same way that even though he has fewer seats in the House than Tip O'Neill did, he seems to challenge the president on a mandate, claiming his own mandate, which I think is really not accurate because we vote individually for congressmen and senators and congresswomen. We don't think of that as a national mandate. But I think you're right. That's a great thing you've thought of there, that it's very hard to encapsulate an era in the name of one person now because of the divisions we have.
After November 6th, what do you think, for you, what do you think we learned as a country when it comes to a coalescing or a mandate, if you will?
Well, I think on the ethnic front, which is the healthiest thing I can say, is that despite all the efforts at voter suppression against minorities and young people to some extent, voter suppression making it harder to vote, against some of the code words and code language that was used against the president, that the people who are white in this country went out and voted the way they normally do. They didn't let it. It's about 40% of the white vote, if you will, voted Democrat, about the same as has been voting under Clinton and under Gore and under recent Democratic candidates. No big change, despite all the history we have in race relations and the difficulty of it, and ever since slavery, the problem of coming to grips with it, that people really did vote on what they thought were their politics, their sense of who murdered the office. They didn't get swayed by a lot of this. They basically voted non-racially, as at least the white community did. And it's so interesting that they were able to sort of ward off the bad appeals made to them and vote just the way they normally do. Working guys and women in Ohio voted the normal sort of, they thought the labor unions were right, and they thought that the saving the auto industry made sense. And if you look at, except in the South where there's that residue of race as a problem, generally, I think the country voted quite normally for talent as they saw it. And as somebody said, they voted for Obama as the future, whereas Romney was a pretty good replica of the past. He wasn't a good statement about the future, and they sort of made that positive decision. I think the country always, this country always overwhelms me at times with how good it can be when it rises to the occasion, and it did it again. It didn't. Not a single comment made by the Democratic opposition about Romney's religion. Not a single reference to it in their advertising or public statements. No reference to the LDS religion, the Mormon religion, by any of the Democratic operatives or consultants or PR people. No attempt to exploit that issue, which was such a good thing, I thought.
But do you think it existed anyway? Do you think people knew it and it still had an impact?
I don't know, because in the areas where it would have had an impact among evangelical people in the South especially, where they are very sensitive about Mormonism and antithetical to it because of, I think, proselytizing and things they don't like at all, I think they were probably pretty conservative in their politics and pro-Republican. And so I don't think in the areas where it would have been exploited, it was exploitable. I think that they voted for their guy. And I think Romney didn't come off as weird in a religious sense or exotic. He came off as just a wealthy guy, sort of what we call a WASP, of high education, of elite Northeastern background, and a prep school guy. And I don't think those were the salient features of the guy, not his religion, I think, except his large family, of course. But when you look at him and his wife together, I think they struck people as pretty healthy, happy people, and happy with who they are. And I don't think there's anything that struck people as odd about him that way, except sort of social elitism, which, you know, comes with the territory.
Speaking of coming with the territory, and you mentioned the fiscal cliff and John Boehner and the negotiations that go on in Washington over the fiscal cliff. So when it comes to the president and any edge that comes with winning re-election and by the slight, but still the margin that he won with, does that help at all?
Well, my experience is that politicians of both sides, winner and loser, should respect the electorate and their most recent decision making, because if you don't respect the electorate, they can tell you're not doing it. And you really want to win the next election, the best way to do it is to respect the most recent one. If you respect the electorate and say, yeah, I hear you, they know you've done that and they feel good about it. They said, oh, my vote counted. So I would say this fiscal deal ought to be a slightly or at least significantly pro-Democrat, but not overwhelmingly. It should be like a 55-60-40 deal, like it was with Reagan or Neal, and in those cases where they came in but they modified, and then when Reagan lost the midterms in 62 or 82 rather, they went back the other way with the Social Security deal. My experience is if both politicians on both sides of the aisle should respect each other's offices, they were all elected, but favor in the deal they make right after the election the way the voters voted, and that way they're respecting not just each other but the voter. And I think that's really important, and not to act like the election didn't happen, but Boehner ought to recognize in some signal way that they lost. And he doesn't have to do it in a kowtowing way, but recognize, okay, like when you're a kid, you know how to play tag. When one person's it, you got to say, okay, I'm it. When you're playing Cowboys and Indians or War Games with kids, oh, you shot me, I'm going to fall down. You have to play the game properly, whatever the stakes. The bigger the stakes, the more importantly, you play the game. If you lose, you have to act like you lost. And if you win, you should act like you won. And then the voters go, yeah, it made a difference that I showed up and voted. And if not, then you're basically saying to the voters, so what? I don't care what you thought. I'm still Speaker of the House, and I'm going to give this guy a hard time. Well, that's not respecting the electorate. That's my view of the thing.
You know, I was watching you on election night, and you made a point that has really stayed with me, because I never realized this before. And you said in your experience that the numbers that mattered are the ones for poll numbers are the ones that come out on Thursday.
Yeah.
And so with that said, on election night, the Tuesday after, were you surprised by what happened?
A couple of things. First of all, the African-American vote, I didn't think would be as committed as the first time. First time when an ethnic group was represented the ballot, a lot of enthusiasm. But it came back again, and so that you saw in Ohio, which was pivotal, 15% of the electorate was African-American as opposed to 11% in 08. So dramatic buildup of African-American support at the polls. people waiting in line for 7 or 8 hours in the African-American communities where they don't have a lot of voting booths for some reason. Well, the obvious reason is suppression in some cases, but waiting in line for hours, that was good. Young people, I thought, wouldn't be as stirred by the first African-American president or this young guy running as they were the last time. They showed up. There was a 1% hike in that group. Women, of course, strong performance, about 53, 54%. I think there's the groups that you think would be not as active and activated the second time around as the first time were. And that told me, that was a surprise, and I think it was a reflection not just of a couple things. One, the black community was resentful, appropriately so, of this Republican effort to suppress their vote through new legislation at the state capitol level in states like Pennsylvania, Florida, where even Clinton talked about one being a blatant example down in Florida, where they cut up Sunday voting because the blacks tended to vote after going to church. The young people showing up because they just did. A lot of that was a pulling operation, a really good social networking with a friend of mine, just my age, just came by and told me this past week about how the incredible work that she was doing down in Miami, where they and down around Coral Gables and Coconut Grove down there, about how they really worked person to person to get out the vote. So a lot of it was just election day, and you didn't know what's going to work until it became election day. And I was stunned. I didn't know who was going to win. I didn't know. I saw Obama up by about a point going into election day. I do generally believe that from Thursday on, you can take the number on Thursday before an election, get the direction of the voter, which direction the polls are going, and project it to election day, that nothing ever happens the last weekend except a continuation of the course that's been set by Thursday before. That turned out to be true, but I was still wondering about it going into our coverage that night. And I was impressed that all the constituency groups on the Democratic side showed up, and they really did show up.
The name of the new book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's a very nice reminder. We are used to seeing Chris on television. It's a very nice reminder that he's a newspaper man and a damn good writer as well. Chris, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much.
It's great. I'm going to keep on writing, and thank you for having me on.
I hope you have a terrific holiday season. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.